I came away believing that I had never Pharisees fell upon us in the room. This is my term for life avoidance, which is also my term for what I see in people who suffer from severe cases of burnout. By life avoidance, I mean the constant desire to hold life, especially one's vocational life, at arm's length. I mean the refusal to immerse oneself in the stream of the human condition. I call it the Belikov syndrome because Chekhov portrays it so graphically in a short story about a man named Belikov, who was a schoolmaster in 19th century Russia. And the story is entitled, appropriately, The Man Who Lived in the Shell. And this is one of the opening paragraphs. You have heard of Belikov, no doubt. Curiously, about him was that he wore rubbers, and a warm coat with an inner lining, and carried an umbrella even in the finest weather. And he kept the umbrella in its cover, and his watch in a great shabby case. And when he took out his penknife to sharpen his pencil, his penknife too was in a little case. And his face seemed to be in a case as well, because it was always hidden by his turned-up collar. He wore dark spectacles and a sweater, stuffed his ears with cotton wool, and when he got into a carriage, he always told the driver to put up the hood. In short, the man showed a constant and irrepressible inclination to keep a covering about himself, to create for himself a membrane, as it were, which would isolate him from outside influences. Actuality irritated. What actuality possibly irritated us? We wonder on the day we receive our bachelor's degree or our master's degree. On that day, for most of us, life is still too fresh to irritate us, or bore us, or repel us. When I left this university 27 years ago, what did I know about burnout? In those days, as now, literature was my guidebook to life, but Graham Greene had not yet published his novel, A Burnout Case. I had seen Hamlet, but was more interested in the sort of way than in Hamlet's decision to be or not to be. It was only after I went out and took up my vocation that I saw the symptoms of life avoidance firsthand among my colleagues and discovered the germ of it in myself. And by reading closer, realized that authors have been writing about it for centuries. So now I'm back to say seven things about burnout. For all I know, my seven discoveries might be old discoveries, but each one at its time was news to me. One, the less tangible rewards of a particular profession, the higher the incidence of burnout. Teaching, for example, that strange profession that has us constantly giving away all we know. Indeed, more than that, all we think we know. And giving it to people who seldom come back to tell us what they think. Which is not to say that most teachers are burnouts. The vast majority of teachers that I have known have been supremely conscientious. But we are all acquainted with that 2 or 4 or 6% who are so lethargic at the high point of their school year is the day they go on strike. Perhaps if Shakespeare were writing today, he would make Hamlet not a prince, but a principal. 2, no one is immune from burnout. No one is immune from the Belikov syndrome. Periodic urge to give up and withdraw. No matter how zealous you are about your calling, there comes a day when the novelty of your vocation disappears and you discover the race you entered was not, as you thought, the 100-yard dash in front of the grandstand. The 100-yard dash isn't even on the program. And what you're running instead is the cross-country marathon, which only begins and ends in front of the grandstand. Between the degree and the mission, you do a lot of running through the woods. I remember the making of the discovery for myself. I won't say what year or at which high school, but it was January. I was standing on a wall to be outside my classroom between period 2 and period 3, and wondering as never before where in the world I would find the strength to persevere through periods 4 and 5 and 6, February, March, April. And I was doubly disheartened because I was really quite fond of teaching, and how could a job I liked be so hard? My students had turned into cannibals, it seemed, consuming me by eating away at my spirit. I felt I had to somehow quit giving so much of myself away. Now, as it happened, there were two veteran burnouts on that fact. For years, I've been going about the business of not teaching, and I took a sudden interest in their methods. One of these was the history teacher who showed films of World War II for 5 hours a day.
We all need respite from our calling. We all need
to step out of America from time to time and sit and shake. That's what vacations and retreats and leisure time are for. And professions that do not have a system of sabbaticals ought to institute. There is a term for such measured withdrawal. It's called rest, and it serves as an immunization against burnout. But the danger is in assuming that if a little withdrawal is good, a lot of withdrawal is better. A lot of it gets you exactly where it got developed off. After years of living in this shell, fell in love with a young woman who moved into this village, and he discovered that he had grown too high up, too remote from life, to relate to her. He had spent so much of his life evading life that he no longer knew how to live. His shell had grown too tough, and he couldn't catch. Five, be forewarned that the vocation you love, like a person you love, will make the most demands on you. I found this fact illustrated recently in a novel by Shirley Bassey entitled Venus. One of her characters, a dedicated astronomer, has gone off to a foreign country to oversee the installation of an enormous telescope. And he writes this in a letter. What an atrocious, sustained effort is required by Ryan to learn or do anything thoroughly, especially if it's what you love. A vocation is a source of difficulty, not ease. To do is difficult enough. To be, more difficult still. To do or to be, there's a difference. It's one thing to teach, and another to be a teacher. It's one thing to write, and another to be a writer. The difference is in the degree of investment. To do is to fulfill your job description. To be is to invest so much of yourself in your calling that you and your calling begin to blend. We have all known certain teachers or nurses or parents or carpenters or clergy or shopkeepers whose dedication made them the emblem of their calling for us. A natural style is Pascal's word for this. Speaking of a book he admired, Pascal wrote this: when we see a natural style, we are astonished and delighted, for we expect to see an author, and we find instead a human being. This, then, is the opposite of the Dalaroff syndrome. Spiritual drawing invests in it. It requires great effort and leads to great satisfaction. It's been my observation that those men and women in whom the flame of dedication burns the highest are the least likely to burn out. Or to put it another way, the more of yourself you invest in your calling, the more interesting your calling becomes. We are all narcissistic enough to be intrigued by our own reflection. And the more of ourselves we see reflected in our work, the longer it holds our interest. Without investment, there is no interest. Six. Most burnouts I've known have been men. And this is a profession which is almost equally divided between men and women. I believe this is because a man is less likely than a woman to keep his mind alive after college. In other words, a man is less likely to read books. I don't mean self-help books and trade manuals. I mean books generally, fiction and non-fiction, conserve the stretch of the line and keep it agile. Go forth and read books I've been saying for 27 years in my students. And all of my students have promised me they would do so. Boys as well as the girls. Men as well as the women. And then I began publishing books and discovered that precisely 5 out of 6 people read books and think about books and respond to books are women. In the days when I was addressing civic groups and study clubs about my books, I was invited to a dozen women's clubs before I was invited to a man's club. And so I thought it was a great breakthrough when the program chairman of the Rotary Club called me up and asked if I could speak on the following Tuesday. Telling myself that at last I had found a group of literate men, I said, yes, I would be happy to speak on Tuesday. And the program chairman said, that's wonderful, because Tuesday is Ladies' Day, and we'd like to have something for the ladies. So I say it once more. I challenge the men of this class to break out of the masculine stereotype that has me believing that the last thing a man is likely to read is his degree, and to keep in mind that if graduation marked the end of intellectual development, it wouldn't be called commencement. 7. Every burnout I've known has come to the point of thinking, usually by mistake, that he is unsuited for his work. Either he will come to believe that he is not worthy of his work, or, and this is more common, that his work is not worthy of him. Sometimes that's true, but more often it's not. I have been struck by the almost miraculous instinct people have for matching themselves up to work that suits them. In the burnout's case, the problem is usually not his being in the wrong profession, but rather his faulty vision of that profession. By this I mean most burnouts are either too nearsighted or too far-sighted. The nearsighted become so preoccupied with small irritations and interruptions, that is, the actualities of their calling, that they lose sight of their long-range aspirations. The far-sighted, on the other hand, spend so much time dreaming of their long-range aspirations that they have trouble dealing with the day-to-day actualities. I am reminded of what it was like when I was a boy to walk a rail. If I didn't watch my feet, I lost my balance. If I didn't look down the track, I lost my balance. The trick was to do both at once. I conclude with 2 quotations illustrating that success requires a balance between the nearsighted and the farsighted, the combination of the visionary and the mundane. About the mundane, C.S. Lewis says this. The great thing, if one can, is to stop regarding all the unpleasant things as interruptions in one's real life. The truth is that what one calls the interruptions are precisely one's life, the life God is sending one day by day. And about the visionary, I quote from Henry David Thoreau. This is a passage I wrote from a card in the wall for my typewriter when I began the first draft of my first novel. And when my prose was becoming especially prosaic, I felt to look up and see this one advances confidently in the direction of his dreams and endeavors to live the life which he has imagined, he will meet the success of unexpected and common hours. If you have built castles in the air, your work need not be lost. That is where they should be.